when we spent time with Sean Martin, a champion Navajo ultra marathoner, he said that when you run, your feet are praying to Mother Earth. You're breathing in Father Sky. You're asking them for their blessings, and you're showing them that you're willing to work for their blessings. And when you can make that connection between your feet and the earth and your breath in the sky, you won't just become a champion, you'll become a warrior.
That was Sanjay Rowell, and this is his incredible story on the Pacing Racing podcast. All right, what's happening, everyone? Welcome back and welcome to the first-time listeners. My name's Steven Langhausen. I am the host of the Pace Racing Podcast. Now, what if running can be so much more than exercise? Well, our guest, Sanjay Rowell, views running as a chance to breathe in the sky, reconnect with breath, and shed anxiety while focusing on the moment, a type of transcendence we so desperately need right now. Now, Sanjay is a filmmaker and a lifelong runner who's been meditating and running daily for the last 27 years. Now, Sanjay studied his meditation practice under Sri Chinmoy, who was an Indian-born spiritual leader who used strenuous exercise and art to spread his message of world harmony and inner peace before his passing in 2007 at age 76. And since then, Sanjay has embraced this way of life and continues to shine light on inner peace and how people can transcend spiritually through running. So Sanjay directed the film 3100 Run and Become, which follows athletes on their quest to enlightenment through completion of a 3100-mile race. It's a life-changing, challenging quest, and he's on today to chat with us about the realities of a mind-numbing 3100-mile race and why ultra running is popular now more than ever, but the multi-day idea has been lost. Now we chat about the relationship between spirituality, running, and transcendence. We also talk about how to unlock your inner strength and bring it to your fitness endeavors like Sri Chinmoy, and where running comes from ancestrally and how our cultures have been affected and how running has changed in the modern era. So we also chat about running monks in Japan who embark on a 1,000-day solo trek around a mountain to achieve enlightenment with only one of two options, either complete the daily mileage or commit suicide. It's honestly a crazy story, and when you listen to it, I truly think you'll think twice about complaining about your next run, and you may approach it with a much more holistic and meditative mindset. Now, I'm happy to be speaking with Sanjay on transcendence through running, and I really think as endurance athletes listening to this podcast that you can take something very special away from this podcast. So I hope it changed your life as it did with mine, and now let's get into it. All right, Sanjay, welcome to the Pace Racing Podcast, man. How are things going?
I'm great, Steven. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Now, you were just telling me that you're currently in New York. So, like, how have you been keeping through all these times?
Well, it's interesting because everyone is incredibly cautious. I'm in Queens, kind of one of the hearts of the epidemic here in the States. But at the same time, you know, it takes me so much less time to get to trails than it ever had. So, you know, apart from the stress of everything going around, you know, I've been able to keep fit and up my miles and get more out of each day.
Yeah, it's stressful times, right? But it's great to stay positive and optimistic in these times. And I mean, first off, thank you for taking the time with us today. I know there's so much we want to talk about, but first off, before we get into the running aspect and transcendence, let's create some context here about your background. Like, what's your story and where did this all start for you? Because it sounded like from a young age, you had this idea of finding a path of discovery rather than following a path of wealth and success that was initially set out for you.
You know, I wish I could say I had those thoughts at a really early age. I mean, I was a model student. Both my parents were immigrants from India. They both had PhDs. So, you know, apart from, you know, just the typical American Northern Hemisphere lifestyle of playing sports, my parents made me study like crazy. But some point in my freshman or sophomore year at college, I realized that none of the things I was doing were actually my own choices. And the result of that was, you know, I felt really indecisive. I felt really insecure about what my future held because I didn't see any any joy. I didn't really see any happiness in it. I mean, I saw success, I saw money, I saw wealth. And at the same time, I'd begun reading a lot of books about Eastern spirituality, Tibetan Buddhism, the Bhagavad Gita, Hinduism's kind of greatest epic. And I realized, you know, if I had so many great professors for my outer life, why would I not seek out the best possible teacher I could find to teach me about the inner life? And that ended up leading me to an Indian spiritual teacher who was based in New York City named Sri Chinmoy. So around my sophomore year in college, I started going to meditation centers of his in Northern California. And I realized that the answers to everything that I had been seeking didn't lie in books or wouldn't come from lectures. They would come from silence. And that eventually got me to New York City at the age of 22. One of the strangest reasons to move to New York City is to find inner peace, but that's why I moved here, and I think that's what I found.
Now, I'm sure when people listen to that, they're thinking, you went to New York City to find your inner peace? But I mean, like, that's where Sri Chinmoy was practicing, and you wanted to practice studies under him. Now, among many things Sri was known for was blending fitness and spirituality, which was something you saw that was rooted in the core of these athletes you worked with when you directed the film 3100 Run and Become. Now, this is one of the biggest endurance races out there, but prior to your movie, this really wasn't a publicized race. Now, like, can you tell us a little bit more about this event? Like, this type of transcendence was something Sri Chinmoy believed in and was very fond of.
So most people don't equate Eastern spirituality or contemplation with physical fitness. But India's greatest epic, again, the Bhagavad Gita, took place on the edge of a battlefield. And it was a conversation between a teacher, Krishna, and his student, Arjuna, both of whom were great warriors. And if you look at the kind of like lineage of Eastern and Western spirituality, you know, there was a big practice of pilgrimage, of walking or traveling long distances, and effectively where the journey itself was the destination. But it wasn't all about negating the physical. And I think Sri Chinmoy moved to New York to kind of show that outer transformation and inner transformation had to go together. At the same time, he grew up in South India, and he was a champion track athlete. And when the running boom of the 70s really blossomed, he was at the heart of it. He was really close friends with Fred LeBeau, who was the president of the New York Roadrunners Club. Fred and a lot of people in New York in the 70s were deeply interested in Eastern spirituality. And if you could believe it, in 1977 and 1978, they opened the New York City Marathon Expos with a meditation by Sri Chinmoy. So he loved to run. He loved athletics. He felt that, you know, you could experience self-transcendence, or you could experience betterment more tangibly if you practiced physical fitness. I mean, if you meditate or pray every day, it's hard to tell, you know, how much better you're getting. But if you practice those things and you run or do other physical fitness, you can get that kind of joy of going beyond your limitations in a lot more tangible way, if that makes any sense.
Oh yeah, no, totally. And so you're a lifelong runner yourself, correct?
Yeah. So I grew up in California, you know, it has 35 million people in the state. And I was one of the top ranked middle distance runners, you know, under 18. And then when I went to college, I was all of a sudden running against people that some of whom, you know, some of them went to the Olympics. And for me, I'd only known running as competition. And I loved training. I loved everything about it. But it's like, I thought the goal was winning, because that's just what coaches had really instilled in me. And by the time I got to the collegiate level, I realized, like, there was no way I was going to win any major races. You know, there were people that were better than me. There were people that loved it more than me. And I kind of stopped. And it really wasn't until I got deeply involved with Sri Chinmoy and, frankly, got over my own mental barriers that I realized that there's a totally different reason to run. And I hope that's what we showed in my film, 3100 Run and Become.
Exactly. And something I want to shed some light on here, where many listeners are Ironman athletes who just want to get the best performance out of themselves and may often stress themselves out over things like a missed workout or not working out hard enough or something like that. Like, you and Sri Chinmoy and all these other multi-day athletes that are on this path of self-transcendence are often looking at running in a much different light. And so for those who haven't heard of this event before, I guess, like, what exactly is this and what's it all about?
Yeah, so the Self Transcendence 3100 mile race is the longest foot race in the world. It requires people to average almost 60 miles a day, that's 60 miles a day, to finish within the 52-day window. And it takes place around a 0.58-mile sidewalk loop in New York City. Now, people might ask, like, why would you ever do this kind of a distance around a loop? But the fact of the matter is, you know, twofold. Number one, you can't accomplish these distances just on willpower. You need to enter into a flow state. And people that have run across Canada, that have run across the United States, have had tremendous logistical issues. You know, if you're on a road, you're worried about cars. You might have to go up mountain ranges and down the other side. You can't get your food, aid, rest stops when you need them. But if you're on a half mile loop, you can forget about the outer logistics and begin to focus really on inner flow. And that's the only way it's possible. I mean, we know about the flow state, and the flow state is, you know, performing at a very, very, very high level. It's not the absence of pain, but it's the presence of bliss. Like when you take away expectation and you bring in bliss, performance increases exponentially. And that's what happens in the 3100. It takes 5 or 6 days for people's bodies and digestive systems to kind of tolerate the pounding and the tens of thousands of calories that are needed, the 5 or 6 gallons of water that are needed. But after 5 or 6 days and the body gets into a rhythm, the mind shuts off and people experience, you know, a pretty much a flow of happiness that supersedes the pain that they might feel. And so our movie looks at that. But we look at the ancestral roots of that flow state, and we go to the Navajo Reservation, we go to the Kalahari Bushmen, we go to the Marathon Monks to understand that these states of high performance, by focusing on happiness, are not strange. And in fact, they're a lot more natural than people might think.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear. And I just honestly can't seem to wrap my head around it and just put myself in their headspace. Like they're racing for days on end around the same block in differing weather conditions, just tapping into their own headspace. I absolutely love it. So these athletes in the movie by no means look like you'd envision being your extreme ultimate athlete. Like they look like just everyday average Joes. So how's this impossible feat made possible by the average people?
So I'll give you just a personal example. While you know, I'm 45 and there's no way I'm going to run as fast as I did in my 20s. You know, after a year of really processing, you know, what the movie meant to a lot of people and the incredible runners I came across, you know, started training again. And I feel like I'm at the tip of the iceberg, but at the age of 45, I did a 2:37 marathon last December. I was supposed to run Boston last week, but I didn't train with the kind of physical intensity that I had in my youth. I didn't care about splits. I didn't care about the miles I was doing. Even though I post to Strava, I didn't care about, you know, what my watch told me. You know, I went into a mantra that a Hopi elder named Rex Talium Tewa told a couple of us. He said that when you perform physical fitness, when you run, you have to find the joy in the exertion. And I'd never thought of that before. Like when you're doing interval training on a bike or in the pool or on your feet, you know, you're just thinking about getting it over with. You're thinking about hitting that split. You're thinking about what it's going to feel like when you're done. You're thinking about how many intervals you've finished, you know, how many you've got left. Or when you're racing, it's like you're thinking about like how many miles, or in the case of the 3100, how many days you've done and how many you've got to go. And it becomes this mind over matter equation. But the fact is that the mind doesn't actually have that much power. You know, if you try to find joy in exertion, all of a sudden you're doing two things. You know, you're trying to stay in the moment. And that moment might have pain, it might have suffering. But the kicker was the idea that in that moment of exertion, there was actually happiness to be found. And I began practicing that in my training. And I can't say it was easy, but after a while I got the hang of it. I realized that, you know, if I focused on the moment, I would slow my mind down and I would peel away the layers of what that pain and effort meant. And deep down in there, without sounding too wishy-washy, there was an absolute world of joy. And physiologically, what that did to me was it separated my mind from thinking ahead, and it slowed my heart rate down. It made me much more conscious of my breath. It made my strides and my form much more fluid. So there was a physiological effect with trying to get into that moment. And that's exactly what the 3,100 mile runners try to do. You can't think about, you know, the next day. You can't even think about the next 6 hours. You have to try to look at every single moment as if you were on a pilgrimage, where every single thing you did was sacred and every single thing you did had something to teach you.
So your movie truly captured the essence of self-transcendence. And for the listeners, this is really inspiring to listen to because many listeners are endurance athletes and we think that mental toughness is a huge component to success in running. But like this goes beyond mental toughness, right? Like this switches the mindset from suffering to essentially enlightenment.
I mean, the interesting thing is like, you know, in a shorter race, you know, in an Ironman or anything less than a multi-day race, you know, you can do pretty well with mental toughness. But imagine having to do 60 miles or 100 kilometers, or the leaders do more. They do, you know, 70 to 115 kilometers a day. But then having to wake up the next morning and doing it again. And then knowing that you might have to do that for 45 more days. You know, very few of us have the willingness to be that mentally tough for so long. And these ancestral traditional runners in the movie, as well as the 3,100 mile runners, kind of show that there's a different mindset that, you know, you can approach running with. You know, some of us approach running to push our bodies to the limit. Some of us push, you know, use running to kind of, or approach running to like look better or feel better. But the one thing I realized I had never known about running was that if you go into it with the intention of becoming a better person, trying to run to become a better person, running will do that for you. And at the same time, the performance limitations get pushed way further down the road. When you're kind of using this mind over matter, you always feel like you always know where the edge is. You always know where the breaking point is. But when you enter into a flow state and the mind has no part of it, there's no telling what your limits are. And that's the idea of self-transcendence, that you can continuously go beyond your capacities. And it's got nothing to do with measuring your splits or measuring your race times. It's kind of counterintuitive that by releasing all expectations of your performance, you can actually do better than you ever thought you could do.
Well, let's chat about running and transcendence a little bit more here in depth. Like, first off, what is the relationship, I guess, between spirituality, running, and transcendence?
So a lot of people have read the book Born to Run. And, you know, we spent time with the Kalahari Bushmen in Botswana, not the first tribe that ever existed, but the one that people feel has been around the longest, 125,000 years. And, you know, we went on a persistence hunt with them. And evolutionary biologists kind of hypothesized that early men and early women had an advantage on the savannah just because we could run long distances. And when I was mentioning it to Bushmen hunters and runners, they laughed. They said our advantage on the savannah wasn't that we had tremendous endurance. We didn't have more endurance than these animals like wildebeest that can run, you know, 1,000 miles in 10 days. What we had, they felt, was a deeper ability to get energy from the land. We could tap into consciousness through the heart and through our soul that would give us more power and more ability than these animals that were much larger than us. At the same time, echoed in that, when we spent time with Sean Martin, a champion Navajo ultra marathoner on the Navajo reservation, he said that Navajos and, you know, a lot of Southwestern Native Americans, they feel that when you run, your feet are praying to Mother Earth. You're breathing in Father Sky. You're asking them for their blessings, and you're showing them that you're willing to work for their blessings. And when you can make that connection between your feet and the earth and your breath in the sky, you won't just become a champion. You'll become a warrior. And so that says it. It's like running's not just about becoming a champion. Running's about becoming, you know, a warrior in life, someone secure, someone stable, someone happy. And it starts with feeling the connection between your feet and the earth, your breath and the sky. And it speaks to something very, very human about running. In fact, one might say that running, dance, movement with our feet and our breath could have been the first religious practice of early women and early men.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. Like this, that's my favorite quote by Sean Martin, and it really strikes deep and hopefully can resonate with some listeners like it did with me. Like, so what is real transcendence? Like, what's it look like, and what does one experience when this happens to them?
Yeah, so scientists kind of call the preliminary state the flow state, right? And they say that's when an athlete has an overwhelming feeling of bliss, and the pain is still in the activity, but the bliss far outweighs the pain. And in that state, they're no longer tied to any particular performance limitation. Now, athletes that have experienced the flow state will say that they're lucky to experience that type of a race once in their lifetime. And I'm sure every listener has had that race where it's like, oh my God, I felt great. And it's like I crossed the finish line and my time was just unbelievable. Or even, you know, even experiencing that in moments, that's when you get into the state of self-transcendence. Self-transcendence doesn't necessarily mean that you're constantly doing a better time. I mean, you can't do a better time every single day of your life and necessarily every single race. But there, you can enter into a state of mind where the idea of limitations don't exist. And in that state, you can actually overcome a lot of inner barriers. You can crush your doubt. You can crush your insecurity. You can crush feelings of worthlessness. And when you come out of the event, you'll actually feel like a better person. In many cases, in a state, in a race, when you get into that state, like, yeah, your performance far exceeds what you thought you could do. But you can actually enter into that state of self-transcendence during each and every workout. You can do a part of your workout better than you ever thought you could. You can feel better on an easy day than you ever thought you could. You could push harder on a hard day, you know, better than you ever thought you could. And that's simply, it's getting into your heart, into your spiritual heart. And now people ask, how do you do that? I mean, it's obviously very difficult to try to learn these things on the run. But if people can practice just the most basic contemplative techniques in silence, like just Google deep breathing exercises and understand how to use your breath to calm your heart rate down, to calm your mind down. And if people can look up just simple visualization exercises, how to imagine, for example, that inside your heart is a vast ocean or a vast forest, or that your mind is as vast as the sky. When you get into a performance setting, whether it's a workout or whether it's a race, you know, you can actually consciously practice those breathing techniques and those visualization techniques and bring a state of peace and tranquility into your effort. But it's not a sedate sense of peace and tranquility. It's a state of energy. It's the idea that peace and tranquility can flood your entire being with energy. And when you're in that state, you know, performance barriers begin to vanish.
Hey, I just wanted to quickly interrupt this chat to let you know by signing up to the Pacing Racing monthly newsletter that you can receive exclusive listener codes to many of your favorite triathlon brands for triathlon apparel, nutrition, and fitness equipment, wheels, bike cases, treadmills, and so much more. So to jump on this, head to pacingandracing.com. And also with the season going virtual these days, I invite all of you to train and race with me virtually by giving me a quick follow on Strava or Swift by searching Steven Lighthouse. And lastly, if you are looking for some how-to videos or product tutorials, then be sure to check out Pacing Racing on YouTube. And of course, be sure to subscribe. All right, now, back to the show. Yeah, actually, I just finished a podcast on breath work, so I can really advocate for the benefits of quality breath work practice and incorporating into your daily habits. And so I guess you just clarified this here, that it all comes down to practice, because I was going to ask, like, at what point will this happen in a race? And will this happen to everyone if they run long enough? Or can this just happen to someone if they're in something, say, as short as a marathon?
So that's the key, right? I think most of my friends run ultras and multi-days because, you know, without a really strong like practice at home, it takes like dozens of miles or a couple days for that experience to become the norm. But, you know, when we spend time with the marathon monks in Japan, you know, they pick one aspirant every 7 years to do 7 years of trekking, of running, 1,000 days spread across 7 years in 100-day chunks. So 1 year they might be doing 100 days, some 1 year they might be doing 200 days. Each day has a set mileage. The first couple hundred days are around 11 miles. The last 100 days or so are around 55 miles a day. And the kicker is that if they don't complete any single day's mileage, any single day circuit, they had to take their life. Now, it seems like with that consequence over their heads, it might just be the most nerve-wracking quest ever. But for them, the training is the preparation. And as they prepare, they learn to focus on bliss. And when you focus on bliss, you have no fear of failure. And so, you know, it's been studied when scientists speak of the flow state. You know, it's been studied that runners can have these monumental races where they dip into a flow state and they have no idea how they got into it and how to get back into it in a subsequent race. But from spending time with the Navajo and the Hopi, it's clear that part of training has to be mental as well, and has to be psychic. Like when you're pushing yourself in workouts, you have to try to enter into the flow state in those workouts. You have to try to feel what it might be like in a race to enter into your heart, to visualize, to slow your breath down. And you'll find that eventually you can turn that on during a workout. And if you can turn it on during a workout, you can definitely turn it on in a race. I mean, my own kind of like super amateur experience of running a marathon in Sacramento last December. I mean, I ran 5:45 pace for the first 23 miles, then had a couple of unfortunate miles and ended up at exactly 6 minute per mile pace as an overall average for the marathon. But it was easy. You know, I don't think I'd run 25 miles at 5:45 or faster pace for the entire year. But I'd practiced slowing my heart rate down. I'd practiced, you know, expelling doubt. I practiced expelling anxiety. So when the race happened, I wasn't surprised when I went through, you know, 10 miles in 57 and a half minutes, through 20 miles in an hour 55. It was just like, you know, are you having fun? Yes. Are you happy? Yes. Is your mind calm? Is your heart calm? Check, check. And so it's like that just came from training. So if somebody told me before the race, like, you've got to go out at 5:45 pace or 5:50 pace, I would have been so nervous and I would have been so focused on that I wouldn't have just let the race experience flow.
That's so true, right? Like, I feel like we've become a society that's on the move 24/7 and we're trying to fit in as much as we can in the shortest amount of time, and that we rely so much on our watches or race data that we forget to just get out there and just run in the purest form. Now, you mentioned the monks of Japan, and I wanted to expand on this some more. So to recap there, they embark on a 1,000-day trek on a mountain, and their only options are to either finish or commit suicide. Like, what's this all about? And can you explain this a little bit more and explain the lineage a little bit more?
For sure. So it was started around 556 AD by the first monks that brought Buddhism from China into Japan. And it actually is a very Buddhist thing that if you set a consequence so high in an activity that across the span of years, that activity will remain pure. And so the consequence of not finishing the 1,000-day trek is death. Now, that might seem nuts, but like, Stephen, let's say you were doing it. And let's say at like day 831, you sprained your ankle. And, you know, we all love you. We think you're a great guy. We might just go, you know, let's just say it's an 830-day trek. And let's just say you did it. You don't have to kill yourself. And so across the span of years, you know, that 1,000-day trek might end up being like an 11-day trek. And it might not have the same type of intensity, and it might not require the same type of preparation. So in this 1,000-day trek, people apply, and one person's chosen every 7 or 8 years, and that person has already spent 10 or 12 years preparing for this. Now, you know, there have been dozens of people who have had to take their life, but no one has actually had to take their life for the last 150 years or so, because the preparation and selection process is a lot more rigorous. But like we mentioned earlier, it's like having that type of consequence might make the whole activity fraught with anxiety, but the practice is in eliminating that anxiety from the start and entering into prayer, entering into a meditative state, and focusing on the Buddha, focusing on the highest consciousness and trying to enter into that flow from minute one. And as people will see in the movie, these monks, they're not wearing hokas. They don't have camelbacks. They don't have, you know, dry wicking fabric on. They're wearing robes, and they're wearing bamboo sandals, and they've got these massive bamboo hats and bamboo staffs. So it looks very much like out of Star Wars. It is probably the most uncomfortable way to do effectively what's about 31,000 miles across those 7 years. So like our main character in the 3100, he's a Finnish paperboy named Ashpri Hanal Aalto, and he's finished the 3100 now as of 2020. He's finished it 15 times, which is more than 45,000 miles. And these monks in Japan, they do 31,000 miles. So it's a tremendous amount of mileage, and it's a tremendous feat just to be able to stay in that place of happiness across the span of years.
So yeah, you brought up a really good point there. So ultra running has gotten much, much bigger these days. But one form of running, which we're seeing less and less of, is this multi-day running. Now, why do you think that is?
It's true. You know, the genesis of multi-day running actually came out of people who were doing road marathons. And, you know, marathoning was always really counterculture until the gigantic marathon started, like the New York City Marathon in the mid-70s. And a lot of runners didn't feel challenged by the marathon, and they pushed to 50 milers, 100 milers. But the idea was always, how can you do the most miles you possibly can? And it wasn't course specific, like, you know, doing the Western States. You can't compare those times to doing any other race. You know, the Hard Rock is extremely hard, Leadville, but they're all different. UTMB is totally different. You can't compare splits across those races at all. But the multi-day circuit really started, you know, based on the idea of how many miles can you do in a set period of time. And so they did things that would be conducive to that. Most multi-days are on half mile or 1 mile or 5 kilometer long loops where you can have access to your aid and assistance, etc., you know, pretty regularly. And that doesn't really appeal, I guess, as much to people who want to just have an experience of running in nature. I mean, I don't know many multi-days or many ultras that are just city-based. I mean, they're always in gorgeous locations, and they involve, you know, a very clear connection between the land and the runner. But Sean Martin's dad, Alan, who's in the movie, who's a medicine man, he says that Mother Nature's under the asphalt as well. At the same time, you know, there's a new phenomenon called, like, you know, the Big Backyards Ultra that was started by the same guy that founded the Barclays Marathon. And that's basically setting up a 4 mile trail or course in your backyard or in a local park and getting people out there to do that one loop one time every hour. And so as people, you know, who know this race will already know, you've got to line up on the hour. You've got to finish the lap of 4.1 miles before the next hour is up. If you finish earlier, you've got that period of rest, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, but you have to start the next lap on the hour as well. And the race is about the last man or last woman standing. And it might take, you know, a few days for the winner to be crowned. And so I think there is a push back into multi-days. And I do know several ultra marathoners who are now looking at doing the 3100 as their next challenge.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear that. And the possibilities are endless to run. And we're fortunate, it's the one thing we could do literally anywhere in the world. And it goes all the way back to ancestral times. Now, when we look back to our ancestors and our culture, where has running evolved from, and why have we lost touch with running from these traditions?
So that's a great question. You know, running had always been about challenging oneself, and racing, competition, performance was always an integral part of it. And in this day and age, I think a lot of people shy away from racing. But racing doesn't have to be about competing against others. Racing is a great way to really put yourself into a mindset that, you know, that gives you the opportunity to really push your limitations or push past your limitations in a way that you never could have understood. And I think that's kind of alluded to in Sean Martin's quote that running will not just make you a champion, it'll make you a warrior. I mean, running in many traditional cultures was part of the rite of passage. For young Navajo girls and young Navajo men, they actually would go on long runs as part of their effectively like, you know, initiation into womanhood and manhood. And even in India, in my own religions, effectively bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, I had to go on a run. And so that there are little remnants that show how important running was to develop character. And I think that goes back to what we were talking about earlier. If you want to run to win, you know, running will give you that experience. You know, if you want to run to look good or feel better about yourself, running will do that. But if you want to run to change who you are, you have to approach running with that. And there's a formula. It's like, number one, you have to be able to be aware of the moments. And that means, I hate to say it, that means not listening to music. You have to be attuned to the actual state of exertion you're in and not be distracted from it. As much as exertion might be painful, you have to peel away the pain and realize that there is an entire world of joy and bliss deep down in that exertion. You have to love to seek that exertion, not because it's going to be masochistic, but because it's going to unleash states of bliss that are very, very hard to get to in normal life. And finally, it's like, you know, if we want to think about running as a lifestyle, what is it going to mean for people to say, how can I stay healthy and fit so I can run as a 90-year-old? You know, I might be embarrassed to go like, oh God, when I'm 80 or 90 running, I'm going to just look like, you know, I'm going to look terrible. You know, it's going to be embarrassing. But what steps do I need to take, not just physically, but with my mental attitude to go, I want to train for the rest of my life? Number one, that means getting out of the mindset of competing against others. Because of course, when you're 80 years old, you're going to be demolished by anybody that you run against. So that means trying to find the joy in the running. And if you can find that joy in the running right now, it becomes that sort of transformative event. And it becomes kind of a part of your day that's as important as meditation. You know, it becomes as important as anything else you might have in your life.
I love it. That's incredible to hear. And I hope to do this for many years to come. So that's exciting to hear. Now, when we mention self-transcendence, is this the same as meditation, or like, how are these different from one another?
So there's a kind of a maxim from Hinduism that says, you know, you have the right to act, but not to the fruits thereof. You have the right to act, but not to the fruits thereof. And that means that, you know, you have to put out effort. You have to exert, but you don't have any say in what the results might be. And in a sense, when you look at performance and training, that's such a liberating idea. It's like, imagine like lining up at the start line and going, there are so many things in this race that are out of my control, but I am going to give it my all. I'm going to react, you know, from a state of positivity and not anxiety, because, you know, even if, you know, I make a move in the last, you know, 10% of the race and, you know, someone else could match it. And even if they make a move, you know, will I have the ability to match that? But if you go into it and just say, I'm just going to have the best experience I possibly can, and that means I'm going to put out maximal effort, but at the same time, I'm going to put out maximal happiness, and I'm going to let that happiness drive the race and drive my ability to act and to react. So, I mean, that particular attitude of dissociating from expectations immediately brings a deep state of peace. Now, it might be hard to contemplate, you know, how to race with that attitude, how to race aggressively and race powerfully when on the surface that sounds like you don't really care. And that's where the training comes in. It's like, if you can train with that attitude, if you can train with patience, if you can train with perseverance, you know, it brings in a whole set of tools. I mean, that's a 3,100 mile race in a nutshell. You can't win that race in one day, but you can lose it in one day. Again, after you've done 60 or 70 miles, you go home at midnight, you know, you take care of your feet, you take a shower, you eat something else, and you have to wake up at 5:30 to be at the course at 6 a.m. And this is day in and day out. So that type of multi-day event teaches us something that most training doesn't, and that's patience. That's the fact that, you know, a training cycle might be 3-4 months long. So if you've got to take an extra day off, if you've got to like modify, you know, your routine according to what to how your body feels, that's okay. If you need to start tapering 3 or 4 weeks out to overcome injuries rather than trading up until the last possible second, that's okay. You know, patience, I think, is something that, you know, we don't necessarily see as a strength in a training cycle, but that's exactly what these ancient cultures teach us. And they teach us that the happiness and the performance lies in patience more than it lies in mind over matter.
Wow, that's very fascinating. And so when we look at these multi-day races, is there any physiological differences between men and women athletes, or can we expect the same sort of times or abilities to adapt to this distance of running?
Well, you know, to be honest, it's still relevant. Like, you know, and I think any female multi-day runner or endurance athlete will agree. Like in the 3100, the top 20 times are all men. But the interesting thing, and I think this is kind of the heart of what's worth really like studying, is that of the men who sign up for the race, probably 50% reach 3,100 miles at the end of the 52 days. But of the women that start the race, at least 75% of them reach 3,100. So there definitely is something there that shows a greater likelihood for a woman to finish the distance than a man. Now, is it physiology? Is it psychology? I have no idea. And I think that the sample size is too small. Like you won't see a woman in 150 mile race, a 200 mile race, you know, where the world's best men are necessarily doing anywhere close to the top 10. But, and this is just my own theory that, you know, just as in male performance, like with the 4 minute mile, it took somebody, Roger Bannister, to break the 4 minute mile before people thought it was possible. I mean, the previous record had existed for 8 or 9 years, but after Bannister broke the 4 minute barrier, you know, within 5 or 6 years, a dozen people had. You see Courtney Dowalter, a female ultra distance runner, you know, doing better than most men, and in some races, you know, doing better than all men in that race. I think that as with men and on the female side, it's just going to take one particular runner in the 3,100 mile race to not measure herself necessarily against other runners, not measure herself necessarily against the leaders, in this case, men, and just go deep within and pull out, you know, a different level of performance. I think once that happens, then that barrier will be broken. But right now there is a barrier. I don't think it's physiological. I think it's more mental than anything, which means it's just a matter of time.
Yeah. So as we begin to wrap this up here, if you had some advice for listeners out there who are struggling with mindset in running, what's your advice to them? Like, how can they look at this as a privilege as and an opportunity for self-growth rather than looking at it as a discipline or just one of those workouts that are still on their to-do list?
So I that's a great question. So, you know, let's say you're cooking dinner for like 20 people. You would never try out a recipe for those 20 people just off the bat. Even a professional chef would have practiced that recipe over and over and over to be able to turn it out at a very high quality for his or her guests. You know, in this way, it's like, if you love racing, if you love training for races and you want to do better and better and better in those races, it's not so much getting into the right mindset for those races on race day. It might be worth trying to get into that type of mindset every day. Like in a race, you're trying to remain relaxed. You're trying to remain conscious. You're trying to remain focused. You're trying to push away self-doubt, anxiety. And if that's the goal to getting or to unlocking higher performance in a race, it's like we can practice those same things during daily training. And what does that mean? You know, usually that means having a supplement to the daily physical training. And that's a daily practice of visualization, of breath work, apart from a training session. And then consciously trying to bring in those contemplative techniques into the training session, you know, not necessarily all at once, but in little bits. It's using training to learn about yourself in the way that we learn so much about ourselves during a race. It's the idea that we can make progress towards a race day psychology or a race day mindset every single training session. And if the idea is to do that, maybe then the goal is to find moments of happiness every day in every session. And that's what the Hopi elder said to us, you know, finding joy in that exertion. You know, if you can do that in every single session, no matter if it's an easy day or if it's a hard day, then it becomes much easier to find that place of power, to find that source of energy when you need it most on race day.
Awesome. That's perfect. I guess as we look at this time in our lives where the pandemic is promoting social distancing, I think now is the time we need this sort of headspace, now more than ever, to become grounded and to connect with the earth around us. But you know, I mean, before we finish up here, is there anything else you'd like to tell the audience in terms of implementing the practice of self-transcendence into their everyday lives?
I go back to the idea of like learning how to meditate. You know, meditation is, you know, people look at it in the modern sense as a tool for battling anxiety, or as a tool that just looks at psychology or just mindset. But meditation was never secular. Meditation has always been a pathway to your highest self. And in the East, we call that our divinity. And we don't separate that from kind of like the universal consciousness or the universal divinity. Meditation takes you to your best self, to your highest self. And you end up realizing that that highest part of you is in everything. In essence, it's like it shows you a much deeper well of power than you could ever get in your mind. So imagine getting access to that power during your races and being able to pull that power out in your races. What does that mean? I mean, that means in the state of a flow, understanding that bliss, joy, peace are incredible assets and are actually tools to physical prowess and to physical power. So, you know, starting that contemplative practice, even if you've never done anything like meditation or breath work before, can produce some pretty quick and immediate results.
That's excellent. Well, Sanjay, I could chat with you about this all day, but I think that's a perfect spot to end it off. I love the takeaways from this, and I hope that anyone listening will take this and start incorporating it into their daily runs. And I think, as you point out, we can still take our training competitively. We just need to be more mindful and aware of ourselves and focus on the earth grounding us and the sky that we're breathing in. So, I mean, anyways, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to chat today, Sanjay, but for those who want to see the movie and they haven't seen it yet, where can they go to watch it or to learn more about it?
So the movie's on Amazon Prime, Google Play, and iTunes in most countries. It's on Vimeo in every country. You can't find it on Amazon.
That's perfect. And you're also working on another movie at this time as well, right?
Yeah, I'm working on a film about the Native American ancestral food system and their food ways. And it ties into the same principles of 3100, that by learning your connection with the land, you can go beyond your own limitations. And you can definitely understand that, you know, we're not alone in this world, that we're part of something much, much greater and much more beautiful than, you know, just our minds and our egos and our day-to-day pedestrian lives.
Absolutely, Sanjay. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure, and all the best, man. Stay healthy.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Awesome. Well, that was a wrap with the incredible Sanjay Rowell. Thanks so much for listening in, everyone. And if you enjoy this episode, among others, then please just take a minute to open up your Apple Podcast app on your iPhone, search Pacing Racing, and then just scroll down to the bottom and leave us a quick written review. It takes less than a minute to do, but it goes a long way in helping me out. So to all who do that, thanks so much. It's highly appreciated. And other than that, happy training, everyone. And if you want to train with me on Zwift, then feel free to drop me a follow by searching my name, Steven Langenhausen. Anyway, take care. Chat soon. Cheers.